Welcome everybody to another episode of The Damage Report. This is going to be a big one. We've got not only some fun little updates from what's going on inside of the White House, another tell-all insider book has been released. Donald Trump is losing it over it. We've got that. We've got Donald Trump, the White House tour guide. That'll be fun. Don't send your kids on that tour though, just a heads up. We also have, I asked on Twitter yesterday, after the Kamala Harris town hall, I asked my Twitter followers, what do you guys want to know about the 2020 primary? Questions you might have about how it's going to go, particular candidates, how I plan on covering and all of that. You guys sent in a ton of awesome questions, so a little bit later on the show, I will be addressing some of those. We've got an apparent attack by some Trump supporters on an actor. We're going to break down the details of that. We also have two awesome guests that are going to be joining us. So Jordan Yule is going to be joining us on the show once again in just a little bit, actually. We're going to be talking about a few different things. The political report about how Wall Street is freaking out over some of the Democrats who are going to be running in the primary this time around, but not freaking out about others. Very interesting. Now there's some talk in New York. Some Democrats are saying that AOC might need to be primaried this next time around. And we'll also be talking a little bit about the town hall on CNN last night. And then later on, Mary T. Long is an American politics lecturer at the University of Pittsburgh. She's going to be joining us to talk about her research into compassion in American politics. So Democrats, Republicans, Trump supporters, those who oppose him, how much compassion do they have for their fellow man in America? She found some very interesting stuff. We'll be breaking that down a little bit later on. But first, let's do a little book club. Every 2 weeks, another book comes out from someone who worked in the White House. And I want to give credit to Brett Ehrlich for identifying that this has always been the case. There's always been the people who worked in the White House that then write their big book. But in the past, it tends to be, here was what was great about our time in office. Here's what we tried to accomplish. Here's the challenges we faced. You know, we did our best. That has not been the case. There are those books for Donald Trump, but they're all written by hacks on Fox News that weren't actually in the administration. All of the ones that we've seen coming out are like fear, hostility, and now Team of Vipers, my 500 extraordinary days in the Trump White House. Team of Vipers, not a team you want to get picked for in elementary school, by the way. But Cliff Sims worked in the White House, had experience with all these people, and Donald Trump, after reading it, I'm sure, is very concerned. He read it. He read all of it. He's a big reader. He's very concerned about what Cliff Sims is bringing up, especially because it's all lies. So he tweeted, a low-level staffer that I hardly knew named Cliff Sims wrote yet another boring book based on made-up stories and fiction. There's some subtle distinction between made-up stories and fiction that I'm not getting as a guy who's written both of those. He pretended to be an insider when in fact he was nothing more than a gopher. Is that how you spell gopher in this sense, in a bureaucratic sense? Is it not like a regular gopher? He signed a non-disclosure agreement. He is a mess. Okay, so one little thing that I can't help but point out. First of all, he definitely didn't read the book. We know that. In all likelihood, I'm about to read to you more of it than he read before writing all of that. Second of all, he can't just say it's made up, it's a lie. He didn't actually have any access. We were operating at much higher levels than he had access to. It has to be boring because he only thinks about things through that shallow, childlike lens. So I will leave it to you to decide if the book is boring. If his violating the NDA is going to be a problem for him, well, they're implying that it will be. Michael Glasner tweeted, the Trump campaign is preparing to file suit against Cliff Sims for violating our NDA. So they are saying that they are going to sue him over it. They have claimed that they're going to sue a lot of people over the past couple of years, and very rarely have they actually gone through with it. So if I was Cliff Sims, I would probably not be scared about that. So what's actually in the book? Why is Donald Trump freaking out like this? Well, Cliff Sims says this, we leaked, we schemed, we backstabbed. Some of us told ourselves it was all done in the service of a higher calling, to protect the president, to deliver for the people, but usually it was for ourselves. So I am going to add a little bit of nuance to this that, look, I'm always interested in finding out a little bit more of what's going on in the White House because we have no legitimate inroads to find that out. These are the sorts of ways that we do, leaks and books. But Cliff Sims did voluntarily work in the White House. He apparently supports large sections of Trump's agenda. He seems to be on the Jared Kushner, Ivanka side of things. So look, he's not a good guy who's giving us unprecedented access. He's a Republican who wanted to work for Trump and bad stuff happened along the way. So is he going to lie in some of this? It is entirely possible. I'm not going to try to sue him. I don't know in particular because I don't have anything to verify it or deny it. But it is likely that some of this will be inaccurate. It'll certainly be, you know, self-aggrandizing and, you know, self-serving and all of that. These books tend to be that. That said, here is some of what he has revealed from his time in the White House. The former White House staffer recalls being told by former White House Chief of Staff John Kelly that working for Trump was the, quote, worst expletive job I've ever had. I don't need that to be verified. I find that very easy to believe. I don't think anyone's super surprised by that. I believe John Kelly has sort of implied as much since leaving the position, so bear that in mind. On Kellyanne Conway, quote, it became hard to look at her without getting the sense that she was a cartoon villain brought to life. Her agenda, which was her survival over all others, including the president, became more and more transparent. Once you figure that out, everything about her seems calculated. Every statement, even a seemingly innocuous one, seemed poll tested by a focus group that existed inside her mind. Or in Bowling Green, wherever that is. Everything is tested, I guess. She certainly sticks to a script, but she's also had a number of different gaffes and blunders that has made her sort of a comic figure. Not just a comic villain, as he is implying, but in a larger political sense, a comic addition to our political discourse. A quote from her that he says she said to him, people apparently think that I care what when they write that I might be fired. If that ever happened, it would be the best day I've had since I walked into this place. Look, I would think that, but I'm assuming there's very little crossover between what I believe about the world and reality and what Kellyanne Conway does. She would probably be okay because I'm sure she would be hired by Fox News the next day, unless things weren't amicable in the leaving between her and Donald Trump, because then would Fox News really want to hire on someone that he's so opposed to? Next, though, and this is interesting. This is sort of a little bit more background about how Trump functioned while Cliff Sims was in the White House. A careful study of cable news, Trump critiques which channel has the best on-screen graphics, which is the Damage Report, obsesses over which reporters repeated the daily talking points, knows the camera angles in every room. He prefers the camera to show the right side of his head, shares opinions on the lighting, and requires his staffer carry a can of his preferred hairspray. Tresemme, Tres 2, extra hold. Yeah. I think it's actually Rust-Oleum Primer, but that's what they're saying it is. So look, here is the thing. Cliff Sims has unwittingly or unknowingly revealed something significant about Donald Trump. He ended up going from businessman to president. Along the way, he should have been a producer on a cable news show because that is what he is interested in. He's interested in the graphics and the camera angles, making sure everyone's ready. The green room is well stocked with snacks and the ratings are certainly good. He would probably be quite happy in that regard. And unfortunately, he did miss it. So look, the book is not even formally out yet. Advanced copies have been sent out, some excerpts. Perhaps we'll get access to it. We will reach out to Cliff Sims, try to get him on the show. Again, bearing in mind all the caveats I gave you about who he is politically and all of that. But it is interesting to see another one of these books come out. And just if you are a Trump supporter and for some reason you still watch this show, what do you think it means that everyone that leaves this administration hated their time there and feels the need to attack everyone that they were surrounded with? I mean, you might think that that just reflects badly on the author, but it has to reflect badly on the person that set up the situation in the first place. That said, Donald Trump is not just president, he's also tour guide for the White House. And so he's been taking people around. This is Josh Dawsey did a report of some of the tours he's taken random guests on. And a couple of interesting little tidbits have come up as a result of that. So here's one thing that he tells guests about former President Barack Obama. Quote, he just sat in here and watched basketball all day, Trump told one of his many delegation's visitors. Quote, or before saying he upgraded Obama's smaller TV to a sprawling flat screen one, according to four people. So this seems well supported by the evidence. First of all, most obviously, to tell all of these people the president sat around watching basketball all day. Do you think he just picked that randomly? First of all, how would he know? He didn't share the White House with him. The staff didn't carry over. He's unlikely to know. Do you think he picked basketball just randomly? I kind of doubt it, unfortunately. Another section from the Intelligencer report. Ironically, this anecdote comes in the midst of an account of Trump devoting hours and hours to showing off his residence to all manner of visitors rather than, say, doing his job. So if your point is Barack Obama doesn't get done the job of president while you are taking people on tours of this place, that is weird. Also, to say, man, he just cared about TV, and by the way, he had a lame TV. I sprung for a much bigger one for all the hours I spend here on executive time. And a small note, I'm sure that if Ricky Strom is watching this, he probably has already taken issue with this. I didn't know this, really, but basketball is generally not televised during working hours, which seems like an important point. Especially if your claim is going to be that the past president didn't take his job seriously and just sat around watching TV as you day after day live tweet Fox and Friends. We know what you're doing with your time. Who do you think you are actually kidding? We know that most people operate through projection and little else. Politicians certainly do. Donald Trump has nothing but that. Every attack against another person is him revealing, to whatever limited extent he has, his ability to self-critique. He turns it all outward, but it is an analysis of his own faults, his own fears, his own concerns. It goes a little bit beyond that, though. It gets a little bit weird. Another thing, this is coming out of Team of Vipers, actually, that he does on this tour. Here's a quote. Flashing a grin, he wants his friends to see where Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky reportedly began their sexual encounters. Quote, we've remodeled it since then, he said on a tour in December, said a person with direct knowledge of this event. In a visit in 2017, Trump told a TV anchor, quote, I'm told this is where Bill and Monica, stopping himself from going further, according to Team of Vipers. We've got a weird perv in the White House. That's what we've got. He's wandering around watching TV and trying to find out where people effed. That's what he spends his day with. He's not like trying to figure out if aliens exist or if JFK was assassinated in the way that we believe, all the stuff that's been hidden historically. He's trying to find stains on the carpets and like the bedspreads of the White House. This is really weird. And then to have a little bit of casual racism against the first black president in American history sprinkled on top of it is perhaps even worse. So if you were wondering what's been going on in the White House, things have apparently not gotten better recently. That said, we do have to take our first break. When we come back, progressive activist Jordan Ewell is going to be joining us to break down some recent reporting on high-profile Democrats and also respond to last night's CNN town hall with Kamala Harris.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
For this. Joining us now to help break down some of the big stories of the day, progressive activist Jordan Ewell. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Always glad to have you on. So there's a few different things that I want to touch on. I want to jump back to a story that we didn't unfortunately get to yesterday, and that was a Politico write-up about some of Wall Street's reactions to people who have either already joined the Democratic primary or look set to. And it was interesting to see who. They seem to have two lists, the candidates that they're scared of and the candidates that they are kind of curious about. How did you respond to that sort of reporting and how they classified different candidates?
Well, I thought it was hilarious that the article touted Wall Street as this kind of kingmaker, right? They mentioned, oh, Wall Street's had this pivotal role in recent elections and run down the list, going back to Obama, and everyone they've backed, with the exception of Obama's first term, has lost. So to the framing of the article itself was ludicrous in that here's this wealthy industry that controls all of these other smaller industries, and everyone relies on them to play kingmaker in elections. And then at the very end, they insist, oh, no, you can't have Warren or Bernie because they're not electable. The industry has exhibited over the past several elections that they don't know who can win. They've shown bad faith. And ultimately, it's a self-serving position for Wall Street to get behind certain candidates, because at the end of the day, they're looking for someone who won't come after them, who will not make them face any repercussions for their actions. And it's an industry that is responsible for 4 million people losing their houses in the financial collapse. This isn't someone I want picking the leader of the country.
Yeah, and especially, like, look, if they're going to support Mitt Romney, for example, which is part of this write-up, okay, I get that. He's a business guy. I get why they'd like him. But when they weigh in on the Democratic side, it kind of seems like, do they really care if the candidate they pick wins? Like, if they choose Cory Booker or whatever and he goes on to lose, does it really hurt them? Because the Republican who will have won is going to favor deregulation, is going to favor cutting corporate taxes. So can we really trust that they care whether their chosen Democrat goes on to win?
No, they want someone who is malleable, who will kind of cater to their interests, who will fight any progressive push from the left. This is why this is the same industry that's scared of Ocasio. And you see people like Mike Bloomberg weighing in today. Just recently, I saw a few minutes ago on Twitter that he likened Warren's wealth tax as a failed policy that is illustrated, the ramifications of which is illustrated in Venezuela. Well, that's not true. Like, we've seen it in the United States under Eisenhower with a 90% rate, and for the next few decades, ranging from 70% to 90% for the top marginal tax rate. And we've seen great growth during those periods. So this whole premise that it doesn't work, again, is a self-serving premise that would only suit to, like, fat in their pockets.
Yeah. So hopefully we can return to this. But there was another big article, a scoop by The Hill this morning, and that was that some Democrats are already mulling, just a couple of months after the election, that new Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez just might have to be primaried. What do you think about that, especially coming as early as it is in this cycle?
If we see someone who is becoming the most popular Democratic politician in recent years, yeah, sure, let's get her out of there. This clearly is not something good. It's ludicrous. This is clearly some establishment Democrat who sees, like, the end of their kind of cash grab coming near. This is probably someone, we don't know who it is because it was a cowardly quote to give anonymously, kind of that backstabbing establishment politics that we're all familiar with. Yeah. But yeah, they say, oh yeah, we need a primary AOC. But what really frustrated me about that article was the framing of elections in general. And they mentioned that there's been city council members waiting 20 years for that seat. Well, that's not how it works. You don't just get the seat. We tried that in 2016 by granting the nomination by decree, and that backfired amazingly. Yeah. So let's further grassroots campaigns and altruistic progressive politics.
Yeah. And by the way, just to be clear for the audience, it's not my position that they can't primary. Of course they can. She primaried someone. She can be primaried. It just seems like if I'm a prospective primary challenge to AOC and I hear some Democrat says we need to find someone to challenge her, but he's so scared that she will crush him, am I really hearing that and thinking, yeah, I want to jump into that volcano? I don't think so.
No, not at all.
So I also saw, related to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Howard Schultz, the guy who's certain to be our next president, was saying today that one of the reasons he feels he needs to challenge Donald Trump is because of extremist left policy ideas like AOC wanting to raise taxes on the rich. Aligning himself with effectively maintaining the status quo on taxes, do you think that this is a winning strategy for Howard Schultz going forward?
No. I think Schultz's strategy plays right into the hands of Trump. As the Young Turks investigative unit just published earlier today, he's donated less than 1% of his wealth to charity. This is a guy who, as so many billionaires do, hoard their wealth. They're against any redistribution. They're greedy. They're selfish. This isn't somebody that should be dictating economic policy or any other policy, national or international.
Yeah.
It's self-serving. It's clearly designed to further his book tour. He just started it. He's selling his book now. It's a self-promotion, purely self-interested ploy.
Now, I wonder if they stock his book in Starbucks. Seems like I'm sure they do. Conflict of interest, but I wouldn't put it past them. Okay, so last night was the first big campaign event for Senator Kamala Harris, who had a town hall on CNN with Jake Tapper. What was your impression of her first big outing in this primary?
So her launch has been pretty good. I think by all objective measure, it's been a strong one. She's commanded headlines. She gets a CNN town hall right off the bat. Some of her answers could have been a lot better. From a progressive standpoint, her dodge on the "are billionaires morally responsible," that was really disappointing, because that's something that politicians now, especially AOC, can unequivocally say. Yeah, it is. It's morally irresponsible to have multi-billionaires in a country where millions of people are living in poverty. I was surprised to hear she did come out and back the Green New Deal last night. She kind of had an ahistorical approach to her record as a prosecutor, which I'm sure she's going to be getting a lot of questions about in the years or the months and years coming forward. We'll see how she handles those going forward. But overall, not too bad. Would like to see some improvement on the economic issue.
Yeah, I do think, I don't know if it's a Freudian slip, but it certainly feels like it's going to be years that we're going to be in this primary. But this was her first attempt to address these concerns. There's going to be a lot of follow-ups, and it's going to be very interesting to see, once some of the big progressives are actively a part of this campaign, how they're going to push her and how her answers to these sorts of questions, including the morality of the existence of billionaires, might change over time. So that is certainly going to be interesting to see.
Definitely.
And Jordan, I want to thank you for joining us on the show. Always good to have you here. If you're not, by the way, audience, if you're not following him on Twitter, you certainly should. Does a great job of digging through the news, identifying video clips and things like that that people need to see. So Jordan, thank you again.
Thank you, John.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I'll be answering some of your questions about the 2020 primary, how we intend to cover it here at the Damage Report, and more after this. We're in month 7 of 40 of the 2020 Democratic primary, and I know that you guys have a lot of questions so that you'd like to see answered. So I asked you on Twitter to send those in. You guys did, and now I'm going to respond to them. To give you an idea of my current thoughts about the state of the primary field, some of the individual candidates, and how this is likely to play out going forward. First question was from William Legate, who says, "What are your thoughts on Kamala Harris endorsing progressive policies? Is she someone you could see yourself supporting during the general election if she wins the primaries?" So in terms of my thoughts on her endorsing progressive policies, that is a little bit complicated. So there are not, she is different than Hillary Clinton in that there are not decades of quotes and speeches and bills she supported and things she's pushed for that lean in the opposite direction. There are some areas where her experience as a prosecutor and things like that lead one to believe that she would not be on the progressive end of certain policies. In terms of what she has said about her personal beliefs, that generally buttresses the idea that she supports progressive values. Now, progressive values leading to bold, aggressive progressive policies is a different step that needs to be backed up by specific policy proposals. So in last night's town hall, I said one of the things that she did best was communicating progressive values in how she speaks. She reminds me of Beto O'Rourke in that regard. Now, in terms of laying out very specific verifiable things she wants to do that are quite progressive, that is a different thing. And we're going to have to see that. Some people were saying, "John, you're being too critical of her. This is the first town hall. You have to wait." Okay, I mean, it's going to happen. Me waiting doesn't mean anything. Time will continue to flow in a linear fashion, and we will see if she will flesh those things out later on. I will say, when we'll get into this a little bit later on, there are candidates like Elizabeth Warren that have been very specific about what they want to achieve. So I don't think it's unfair to expect a little bit more detail. Now, in terms of, is she someone you could see yourself supporting during the general election if she wins the primaries? Yes, yeah. There are definitely things that a candidate could say and then win the Democratic primary that would make me not support them. If they wanted to round people up and execute them, I'm probably not going to vote for them. If they wanted to cut the corporate tax rate down to 10%, I probably would not support them at that point. But so far, there is no one who has announced that they are running for the Democratic primary. So I'm not including independents like Howard Schultz or whatever, that has committed any sort of, you know, original sin in terms of politics that I could never support them against Donald Trump. I have been very aware of what Donald Trump has achieved as president. That is sort of the whole point of this show, is to keep a log of that day by day. The idea that I am going to simply lay down and accept 4 more years of Donald Trump would require special circumstances that have not yet been achieved. ND asked, do the candidates have concrete programs written down? Kamala Harris supports a Green New Deal. What does that mean respectively, including the details? Has anyone a tax bill in the program like the bill proposed by AOC? Which minimum wage models are considered? So I haven't seen much detailed information about minimum wage proposals. I know that some candidates have talked about $15 or more. That has not been formalized that I've seen. In terms of her support for a Green New Deal, we are definitely going to be looking for more details on that. Because how I define the Green New Deal, how environmental activists define the Green New Deal, is very different than somehow politicians want to define it when they say that they support it. Now, she said she supported it. That is a great step. She talked a little bit about some of the things she wants to do in terms of subsidies, but there's a lot more to the Green New Deal than just that. So we will be waiting to see. But this is not just about Kamala Harris. Many of the candidates have not been incredibly specific on a lot of things yet. So we will be continuing to look for that, and we will keep you updated as we go on. DR Todd asked, how do or should candidates build a strategy to reunify the country after the divisiveness of the Trump presidency? What needs to be done to prevent another MAGA cult following? If you have an answer to that second question, then please send it to me so I can write a book and make a lot of money, because I don't think that anyone necessarily knows exactly. There's a lot of different theories about why Donald Trump generated the sort of support that he did over and above other Republican candidates. Our guest in just a little bit actually has some interesting data on that. In terms of bringing people back together, I think that the bar is actually very low for that. I think that simply not pursuing wildly immoral policies like family separation, a trans ban in the military, a ban of Muslims entering the country, things like that would go a long way towards reunifying us and restoring some sort of normalcy or sanity to American politics. I don't think that people really need to go out of their way to achieve that. They can go farther, and I hope that they do. Other Planes of There says, TYT's commentary about these candidates has generally focused on policy and very little on donors behind them. Shouldn't it be the other way? If they're being bought, what does it matter what their policies are? I think that that is a fine critique. I just don't think that it's an accurate critique at this point. I would say that a lot of coverage of the candidates, writ large across the entirety of multiple media platforms and things like that, might be more focused, I would say not even on the policies, but on more shallow stuff, and then even less so on the donors. But we talk about that constantly here on TYT. I mean, just earlier today, we were talking about Wall Street being favorable towards certain candidates like Gillibrand, Booker, Kamala Harris, things like that. We had a reporter from publicintegrity.org specifically to break down Kirsten Gillibrand's donations. You know, Better O'Rourke isn't even a declared candidate, but we've talked about donations that he's received. I would say that if you want analysis of candidates' funding, so far there is no one that provides more of that or better of that than TYT. But I hear your criticism. We will continue to do that, and we'll try to do even better in the future. Bradley Gulkey asked, why are people so quick to pick their candidate already? Most of us hardly know anything about the majority of them. Also, will candidates be, quote, progressive when they haven't been in the past? So on your first question, I think one of the reasons that people are quick to pick the candidates that they intend to support is, first of all, some of the candidates are not new. So if you supported Bernie Sanders in 2016, or hypothetically Hillary Clinton, and you thought that they were going to run again, you might be predisposed to support them again, hypothetically. If you have liked Joe Biden for 35 years, you might still like him. Or you might have, over the past couple of years, become really excited about the possibility of some other candidate, about Tulsi Gabbard or Beto O'Rourke or Kamala Harris or whoever. So I don't think that it's necessarily different than in past election cycles that people already have someone that they're favoring. I hope that while we might have a preference, that we do keep our eyes open and see what do they actually propose? How do they communicate? And also, how do they poll against Donald Trump? Not now, much further into it, but I am interested in who has the best chance of beating him. I think that it tends to favor candidates like Bernie Sanders, but we will see if that changes over time. And so hopefully people will continue to update their evaluations of all this as things go on. In terms of will candidates be progressive when they haven't been in the past, yes. Yes, some of them will be more honest, some of them will be less honest, but it seems very unlikely that someone's going to run, you know, a Jim Webb campaign and do any better than Jim Webb did back in 2016. Lamar Patrick Bland says, how even-handed must yourselves and we be from this point and through the primary of accusations surely to arise, especially when news once shed light on sketchy actions against candidates, like when someone tried to hire women to accuse Bernie Sanders of sexual harassment. I'm not actually familiar of anyone trying to hire women to accuse Bernie Sanders of sexual harassment. There was concern expressed by women who were on his campaign about other people on the campaign, and I haven't seen anything to imply that those women are being dishonest in any way. I also haven't seen any claims against Bernie Sanders. But we do have to be critical of any accusations of anything involving past quotes, about donations, all of that, everything. We have to be critical, and we will be critical over the next year. But again, we have to be willing to update our evaluations of this as time goes on. So we'll not accept anything uncritically, but we also won't just write things off because they reflect poorly on a candidate that we support. I have been trying, and I will continue to try to get everyone that I can to stop thinking of politicians as angels and demons. It should not be a situation where we have things so locked into our brain that it's like, you know, like water off of a duck or whatever. If something bad comes up, a position, a quote of someone that we are predisposed to like, we can't simply write that off. And too many people are really fast to do that. By the same token, if someone that we do not currently support proposes something good, something progressive that looks likely to help the country, we can't just always say, ah, they're lying. That doesn't mean that we have to accept it uncritically, but we should be willing to accept that the weight of history and the thrust of politics is actually going to move people, not just in their quotes, but also in their positions as well. Evan Briggs says, are you worried Democrats saying their main priority to defeat Trump sounds a lot like 2004? Maybe not in the same way that you are. I mean, 2004 was the first presidential election that I paid a great deal of attention to. The stakes were incredibly high in 2004. I wish that John Kerry had won. It hurt America, it hurt the world that Bush did win back in 2004. And wanting to beat the current president is an important goal. It's not the only thing, it's not the most important consideration, but it is important. Now, I will say, some people will say we have to elect someone who can beat Trump, and they don't mean the person who's polling best against Trump. They mean the person I think is best is most likely to beat Trump. So no, we have to actually have data to support these sorts of things. There's also a question about ranked choice voting in the primaries. As of right now, it seems unlikely that they will do that, but I know that congressmen like Jamie Raskin are pushing for that to happen. We're actually reaching out to the congressman to see if he'll come on and talk about why we should be pushing for that. It seems unlikely. There have been a lot of reforms to the primary process already over the past year. That would be a great one, but I don't know that we'll necessarily see it this time around. Although, considering how packed this field is going to be, that would certainly be a good thing. Anyway, we're going to continue to touch base with your concerns about the primaries, your questions about the primaries as we go forward. For now, those are some of my thoughts. We are going to take a break. When we come back, more for you. I'm old enough to remember when the term compassionate conservative was thrown around, and the term compassion generally was something that was talked about in politics. It certainly seemed to be absent in the 2016 election, but what's really going on under the surface when it comes to the different parties and compassion in politics? Joining us now to help break down some of her research is American politics lecturer at the University of Pittsburgh, Mary Long. Mary, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So you did a write-up recently of some of the research that you were conducting back during the 2016 Republican primary, right about when it closed, having to do with compassion in the different political parties. And you found something very interesting about Donald Trump that we're going to turn to in just a minute. But before we get to that, in general, looking back over multiple elections, Democrats and Republicans, are there big differences in how much compassion they tend to experience for their fellow American?
So no, and that was the interesting thing that I found. So what I did was I had a survey. I actually looked at survey questions across several different waves of surveys, starting in 2002, 2004, 2008, and 2012. And they have these questions on there that basically ask people how they view themselves. And one of the questions was, you know, how much you agree with the statement, I have concern for others in need, people, or another question was people should worry about themselves and not worry about others so much. And people ranked themselves how much they agreed with that or disagreed with that. And there was actually a wide variety of responses. So it wasn't like you might think where everybody said that they were super compassionate on those types of questions. instead, there was a variety. And what I found was that on average, Republicans and Democrats were the same. And this was a little bit surprising to me, but not really. Because when you think about those questions, those are about how you see yourself and potentially how you interact with other people. And from my own life, knowing, you know, lots of friends and family who are Democrats or Republicans, you know, I haven't noticed a difference in sort of personal interactions with people or, you know, kind of general compassion. We can get into politics in a moment, but I wasn't that surprised by that. But it was a big contrast to some of these other measures, things like racial attitudes, things like measures of authoritarianism, so authoritarian personality. So all these things that sort of increasingly divide Republicans and Democrats in the public, you know, you don't find that when you ask about how compassionate people are in terms of their, you know, just how they see themselves personally. So,
well, that is certainly interesting because we hear liberals described as bleeding hearts, but we also know that Republicans tend to identify more strongly as Christians, people who are inspired to see their fellow man in a different way based on their religion. So it's interesting that in general you don't find huge differences. But when it comes to Trump supporters, you did find something. And I would imagine that since their slogan is Make America Great Again, it's about improving things, there must be a lot of compassion, right?
Well, you know, I initially wrote this article for The Conversation, and the headline was "Who's more compassionate, Democrats or Republicans?" And I liked that headline that the editor chose, and then it got picked up by Raw Story, which is fine. The way The Conversation works is different publications can pick it up, and they rewrote it and they wrote Trump supporters significantly lack compassion, and I really just found only a hint of that. That would be something that you would have to study in much more detail. This was one study that I did, and it was a survey of about 1,000 people, and it was during the primaries. And essentially, there was a difference between people who supported Trump at the time and people who were Republicans but didn't support Trump. And so the Republicans who didn't support Trump had responded to those compassion questions the same as the Democrats. But the Republicans who did support Trump in the primary at that time on this one survey did score significantly lower. So, you know, like a lot of social science work, this would need to be replicated, and we would need to really dig into this and see, you know, how were they interpreting the questions? What did it mean to them? But I did find it interesting. And part of why I found it so interesting was because a lot of my research is looking at how do elites, so political leaders' messages potentially influence these types of responses and these types of behaviors in their constituents. And so, as we know, Donald Trump didn't use much compassionate language in his campaign. And he actually used far less compassionate language than many other presidential candidates, including Republican candidates. So usually when you're running a big national campaign, you are kind of trying to sound caring and compassionate. Mm-hmm. And he really didn't. With a few exceptions, that was not part of his repertoire of things that he was trying to appeal to. So my initial reaction was, you know, is some of this actually a factor of people answering these questions who are supporting Trump, who are kind of responding to his rhetoric as well? So. Mm-hmm.
And so I assume that were there to be some sort of follow-up to this, an analysis of his speeches would probably be a part of it. And looking into to whatever extent that you can, did he just happen to attract these sorts of people, or was there any sort of adaptation over the course of a campaign? Did he do anything to sort of get these people on his side?
Exactly, yeah.
And one thing that I think also complicates this is, so at the time that you were doing this analysis, Trump supporter means people who choose Trump over other Republicans, whereas now Trump supporter means a lot of Republicans, even people who didn't choose him over Jeb Bush or Ted Cruz or anything like that. I did have one other question, though, and that is there was another wrinkle, and it was that regardless of how much compassion people personally feel in their life, there does seem to be a bit of a difference between Republicans and Democrats in the connection between that personal sense of compassion and their political activity. Is that something that you see continuing going forward?
Yeah. So that was a pretty regular occurrence. So what you could do is you could take how compassionate somebody said they were and use that to predict their views on a bunch of different things. But that really only worked for Democrats and for liberals. So for Democrats and for liberals, the more compassionate they were, the more opposed to the death penalty, the more in favor they were of providing government services to the poor, of providing health care, things like that. And then for Republicans, you didn't see that connection. You did see it with things like volunteering and charity, so things in the private sector. So the more compassionate they were, the more likely they were to volunteer, give to charity, things like that. And the only political issue you saw it for Republicans was actually abortion, where for among Republicans, the more compassionate they were, the more likely to say that they were against abortion, more pro-life. And that might make sense because that is an area where you've seen political rhetoric obviously being used on behalf of, I didn't mention immigration. That's another a big issue. You could see Democrats using more compassionate language on behalf of immigrants and people who need government services and things like that. Potentially an issue where Republican elites might use compassion would be for the unborn.
Interesting. Well, Mary Long, we really appreciate you joining the show today. Fascinating research, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break. We come back just a little bit more to close out the show. Going to close out the show with some unfortunate breaking news, and that is one of the stars of Empire, actor Jussie Smollett, has apparently been assaulted. Details are still breaking about the nature of the assault, but it certainly appears to be a hate crime conducted by two men who apparently are supporters of Donald Trump. As with any story like this, we need to give the caveats that we are getting initial information. Some details might change in the future. If they do, no one will care that we give these caveats, but we do them regardless. This is a serious attack no matter what, whether it turns out that they're supporters of Donald Trump or not, but it does seem to play into the idea that this is a hate crime. So here are some of the details that we have right now as of TMZ's initial reporting. Sources directly connected to the actor told TMZ the actor arrived in Chicago from New York late Monday, and around 2 a.m. he was hungry and went to a Subway. We're told that he walked out. Someone yelled, "Aren't you that F-word of Empire N-word?" So not much of that is translatable for consumption by a mass audience, but you get the hate implicit in almost every word of that statement. The two men, described as both white and wearing ski masks, viciously attacked Jussie as he fought back, but they beat him badly and fractured a rib. They put a rope around his neck, poured bleach on him, and as they left, they yelled, quote, "This is MAGA country." Which, just a point, like, anyone who would do any of this stuff, say something like that, obviously these are not well-adjusted people, these are stupid, hateful people. Wouldn't the whole country be MAGA country if you believe in MAGA? I don't really understand what that means. So he was severely beaten. He was taken to Northwestern Memorial where he was treated. He was discharged later Tuesday morning. And according to PBS NewsHour White House correspondent Yemiche Alcindor, she got off the phone with the Chicago Police Department. An official there confirmed that the department is, in fact, looking into this beating to confirm or deny if it is a hate crime. Look, if the details are borne out from what these sources who have spoken to the actor who went through this tragedy, if those are true, this is every bit a hate crime. This is the definition of a hate crime. This is why those laws actually exist. This is people who apparently were driven by a combination of homophobia and racism, or homophobia and racism, because, of course, that intersection can be even more disastrous, as we see, unfortunately, in the news very often. A lot of activity going on social media around this issue. People don't want to get out ahead of the facts, but it does look like another in a long string of incidents like this that confirm some of the worst fears that we have about a segment of our population. So more details to come as they are released. Really fast, Shybuy Gemini posted a review on iTunes saying that they had only heard about progressives 4 years ago, and TYT helped flesh out that concept for them. They really liked the main show. Now they're liking Damage Report. Thank you so much for doing that review. Anyone who leaves a review on iTunes, you help out the show so much. We really do appreciate it. Thank you for watching this episode of The Damage Report. We'll be back tomorrow with JR for more. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.